His response was a span of total stillness. "Of course," he said dully. "I knew it. I just wouldn't admit to myself that I knew." He was their recruiting agent, wasn't he? One of their earliest and best. He chuckled. It was a sound of bitterness and longing. "That night, when they got Ken Daniger, I thought that they had not sent anyone after me." The effort by which he made his face grow rigid was almost like the slow, resisted turn of a key locking a sunlit room he could not permit himself to examine. After a while, he said impassively, "Dagny, that new rail we discussed last month, I don't think I'll be able to deliver it. They haven't lifted their regulations off my output. They're still controlling my sales and disposing of my metal as they please. But the bookkeeping is in such a snarl that I'm smuggling a few thousand tons into the black market every week. I think they know it. They're pretending not to. They don't want to antagonize me right now. But you see, I've been shipping every ton I could snatch to some emergency customers of mine. Dagny, I was in Minnesota last month. I've seen what's going on there. The country will starve. Not next year, but this winter. Unless a few of us act, and act fast. There are no grain reserves left anywhere. With Nebraska gone, Oklahoma wrecked, North Dakota abandoned, Kansas barely subsisting, there isn't going to be any wheat this winter. Not for the city of New York, nor for any eastern city. Minnesota is our last granary. They've had two bad years in succession, but they have a bumper crop this fall, and they have to be able to harvest it. Have you had a chance to take a look at the condition of the farm equipment industry? They're not big enough, any of them, to keep a staff of efficient gangsters in Washington or to pay percentages to pull peddlers, so they haven't been getting many allocations of materials. Two-thirds of them have shut down, and the rest are about to. And farms are perishing all over the country for lack of tools. You should have seen those farmers in Minnesota. They've been spending more time fixing old tractors that can't be fixed than plowing their fields. I don't know how they managed to survive till last spring. I don't know how they managed to plant their wheat, but they did. They did. There was a look of intensity on his face, as if he were contemplating a rare, forgotten sight. A vision of men. And she knew what motive was still holding him to his job. "Dagny, they had to have tools for their harvest. I've been selling all the metal I could steal out of my own mills to the manufacturers of farm equipment, on credit. They've been sending the equipment to Minnesota as fast as they could put it out, selling it in the same way, illegally and on credit. But they will be paid this fall, and so will I. Charity hell! We're helping producers. And what tenacious producers. Not lousy, mooching consumers. We're giving loans, not alms. We're supporting ability, not need. I'll be damned if I'll stand by and let those men be destroyed while the pull peddlers grow rich." He was looking at the image of a sight he had seen in Minnesota, the silhouette of an abandoned factory with the light of the sunset streaming unopposed through the holes of its windows and the cracks of its roof, with the remnant of a sign, Ward Harvester Company. "Oh, I know," he said. "We'll save them this winter, but the looters will devour them next year. Still, we'll save them this winter. Well, that's why I won't be able to smuggle any rail for you. Not in the immediate future. And there's nothing left to us but the immediate future. I don't know what is the use of feeding a country if it loses its railroads. But what is the use of railroads where there is no food? What is the use anyway?"
"It's all right, Hank. We'll last with such rail as we have for..."
She stopped. "For a month?"
"For the winter, I hope."
Cutting across their silence, a shrill voice reached them from another table, and they turned to look at a man who had the jittery manner of a cornered gangster about to reach for his gun. "An act of antisocial destruction," he was snarling to a sullen companion. "At a time when there's such a desperate shortage of copper. We can't permit it. We can't permit it to be true." Reardon turned abruptly to look off at the city.
"I'd give anything to know where he is," he said, his voice low. "Just to know where he is. Right now, at this moment."
"What would you do if you knew it?"
He dropped his hand in a gesture of futility.
"I wouldn't approach him. The only homage I can still pay him is not to cry for forgiveness where no forgiveness is possible."
They remained silent. They listened to the voices around them, to the splinters of panic trickling through the luxurious room. She had not been aware that the same presence seemed to be an invisible guest at every table, that the same subject kept breaking through the attempts at any other conversation. People sat in a manner not quite of cringing, but as if they found the room too large and too exposed. A room of glass, blue velvet, aluminum, and gentle lighting. They looked as if they had come to this room at the price of countless evasions, to let it help them pretend that theirs was still a civilized existence. But an act of primeval violence had blasted the nature of their world into the open, and they were no longer able not to see.
"How could he? How could he?" a woman was demanding with petulant terror. "He had no right to do it."
"It was an accident," said a young man with a staccato voice and an odor of public payroll. "It was a chain of coincidences, as any statistical curve of probabilities can easily prove. It is unpatriotic to spread rumors exaggerating the power of the people's enemies."
"Right and wrong is all very well for academic conversations," said a woman with a schoolroom voice and a barroom mouth. "But how can anybody take his own ideas seriously enough to destroy a fortune when people need it?"
"I don't understand it," an old man was saying with quavering bitterness. "After centuries of efforts to curb man's innate brutality, after centuries of teaching, training, and indoctrination, with the gentle and the humane."
A woman's bewildered voice rose uncertainly and trailed off. "I thought we were living in an age of brotherhood."
"I'm scared," a young girl was repeating. "I'm scared. Oh, I don't know. I'm just scared."
"He couldn't have done it."
"He did.
But why?
I refuse to believe it.
It's not human."
"But why? Just a worthless playboy."
"But why?"
The muffled scream of a woman across the room and some half-grasped signal on the edge of Dagny's vision came simultaneously and made her whirl to look at the city. The calendar was run by a mechanism locked in a room behind the screen, unrolling the same film year after year, projecting the dates in steady rotation in changeless rhythm, never moving but on the stroke of midnight. The speed of Dagny's turn gave her time to see a phenomenon as unexpected as if a planet had reversed its orbit in the sky. She saw the words, "September 2nd, moving upward and vanishing past the edge of the screen. Then written across the enormous page, "Stopping time," as a last message to the world and to the world's motor, which was New York. She saw the lines of a sharp, intransigent handwriting. "Brother, you asked for it. Francisco Domingo Carlos Andrés Sebastián D'Anconia." She did not know which shock was greater, the sight of the message or the sound of Reardon's laughter. Reardon, standing on his feet in full sight and hearing of the room behind him, laughing above their moans of panic, laughing in greeting and salute and acceptance of the gift he had tried to reject, in release, in triumph, in surrender. On the evening of September 7th, a copper wire broke in Montana, stopping the motor of a loading crane on a spur track of Taggart Transcontinental at the rim of the Stanford Copper Mine. The mine had been working on three shifts, its days and nights blending into a single stretch of struggle to lose no minute, no drop of copper it could squeeze from the shelves of a mountain into the nation's industrial desert. The crane broke down at the task of loading a train. It stopped abruptly and hung still against the evening sky, between a string of empty cars and piles of suddenly immovable ore. The men of the railroad and of the mine stopped in dazed bewilderment. They found that in all the complexity of their equipment, among the drills, the motors, the derricks, the delicate gauges, the ponderous floodlights beating down into the pits and ridges of a mountain, there was no wire to mend the crane. They stopped like men on an ocean liner propelled by 10,000 horsepower generators, but perishing for lack of a safety pin. The station agent, a young man with a swift body and a brusque voice, stripped the wiring from the station building and set the crane in motion again. And while the ore went clattering to fill the cars, the light of candles came trembling through the dusk from the windows of the station.
"Minnesota, Eddie," said Dagny grimly, closing the drawer of her special file. "Tell the Minnesota division to ship half their stock of wire to Montana.
But good God, Dagny, with the peak of the harvest rush approaching, they'll hold through it, I think. We don't dare lose a single supplier of copper.
But I have, screamed James Taggart when she reminded him once more. I have obtained for you the top priority on copper wire, the first claim, the uppermost ration level. I've given you all the cards, certificates, documents, and requisitions. What else do you want?
The copper wire.
I've done all I could. Nobody can blame me.